The dynamics of race, class, and economic globalization have prompted third world nations to engage in wholesale trafficking of women. And the shadowy realm of the sex industry is not the only place where these women are trafficked. They are an exportable and exploitable commodity in legitimate but low-wage service work, such as child care, elder care, and care of the sick. Dr. Grace Chang of Oakland, California, has documented the trafficking of women in service industries in a book called Disposable Domestics, Immigrant Women Workers in the Global Economy. In an interview at community radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California, Dr. Chang described how the exploitation of women has become an economic necessity for many developing nations. When people say the phrase trafficking in women, most people will automatically connect that with the sex industry, with prostitution. But your book, Disposable Domestics, Immigrant Women Workers in the Global Economy, shows that trafficking in women occurs in a lot of industries we would call legitimate. What examples would you have of that phenomenon?
I definitely focus on other industries that are considered, quote, socially acceptable, in fact being promoted by the governments of many of these sending countries, including domestic work, child care, nursing, home health care, hospice work, all of these various forms of care work that are thought to be more acceptable, but in many ways are similar to sex work in that it is labor that is traditionally thought to be female and are primarily giving service.
Why are women now an economic commodity to be exported?
Because so many of these industries are really explicitly set up to export women. And the sending countries can benefit. Just to give you a sense of the numbers, in 1994, the Philippines reported getting remittances back from their overseas workers, these women workers, of $3 billion that year. And that was just sort of the official number. The unofficial number, or the number of remittances beyond that, that came in through informal channels, was identified to be something like $6 or $7 billion. That was the Philippines' largest source of foreign currency, and it even surpassed the income that they had from sugar or minerals. It also represented 3.4% of the gross domestic product, and this is more telling, it represented the entire interest payment on the country's foreign debt for that year, which is a huge sum at stake there. If the industry of migrant women who were sending these remittances back were eliminated entirely, that is a huge source of foreign currency and a huge source of repayment of the foreign debt that would be eliminated. So the Philippine government has a huge stake in making sure that that industry is maintained.
And what other countries are in a similar situation as the Philippines?
Other countries include Malaysia, India, many of the South Asian, Southeast Asian countries. I want to stress that most of these sending countries are thought to be channeling women into the United States. They are also channeling women into Italy, into Middle Eastern nations, into Japan and Canada. So it's not confined just to the United States.
And it wouldn't necessarily be a transfer always of women of color serving white people so much as a lot of poor women who happen to be of color serving the wealthy nations?
Absolutely. And also, you know, women of color from, say, the Philippines may find that they will have Filipino employers here who are of upper class status. Or there have been many incidences of Indian women providing domestic work for, you know, Indian women of the upper classes, or Indian families, rather, of the upper classes in New York, and, you know, abuses documented there. So it's not just women of color serving white families. It's also women of color serving exploitative employers from their own, technically from their own home countries.
And what kind of exploitation are we talking about?
Everything from low wages or no wages in some cases, no benefits, really poor working conditions, and really gross mistreatments of people not even being provided beds to sleep in, or some people have been forced to sleep in closets, in the hallway, in the room of the children that they are taking care of. Sexual harassment is really rampant. Twisted psychological torture. One woman who was found to have been forced to wear a dog collar.
The governments tolerate this abuse of their own citizens. Why is that the case? Why are they needing this foreign currency and this hard currency in such a way that they'll do this to their own citizens?
They, in fact, really glorify it. You know, there have been many official statements by ambassadors, say, from the Philippines to Canada, to the United States, saying these women are our new heroes. They are the heroes of our new economy. And it definitely traces back to the numbers that I was talking about earlier, where the country is so largely dependent on the income from remittances and what it represents in foreign currency as indebted nations. That's very much connected with structural adjustment programs that have been imposed on so many indebted nations in the third world. Structural adjustment programs are essentially preconditions that are put on indebted nations by agencies like the World Bank and the IMF. So preconditions for loans will include everything from requiring an indebted nation to slash social spending, slash wages, privatize state industries, open up to foreign investment, increase exports. And so essentially, it's sort of a two-tiered attack. It is an attack on the social service system of an indebted nation. And two is that it's really an attack on their subsistence economies. So that if you have the IMF and World Bank subsidizing and supporting agribusiness, let me take an example in the Philippines, much of rice production now has been so displaced by growing orchids, and people are very clear, we don't eat orchids, you know? So it's not subsistence production by any means, and it's also not production for the consumption of the people. And this is the type of displacement that happens through structural adjustment programs that essentially forces small farmers completely out of business and unable to maintain a viable income anymore. So the different ramifications for families, and especially for women and girls, is that they are suffering in nutrition, they're suffering in healthcare. Young girls are more often forced to stay out of school and to work in order to supplement the family's income. And usually things become so difficult that girls and women are now in great numbers fleeing to the cities from the villages to look for work in, say, manufacturing and in the high-tech industries, and are from that point leaving to other first world countries to do service work because the networks have been set up so easily by the government for this export of women.
Again, your book, Disposable Domestics, Immigrant Women Workers in the Global Economy. You do talk some about the history of this type of immigration and the Bracero program in Mexico, mm-hmm. which was actually bringing male workers in. Are women now the preferred worker export?
I would say that they are the preferred labor within those industries, within the service and what I call the intimate care industries in particular. I think that one interesting trend to look at is that they are being perceived, at least, as somehow now outnumbering men, or they're being perceived now as a greater threat, perhaps, than male immigrant laborers. Whereas historically, there's been a lot of focus on men immigrants as threatening other people's jobs, as depressing wages. Now that there is such a public focus on women immigrants, the rhetoric is really different. It takes a different shape entirely, where the focus is on women as breeders, women as people who are bringing in other family members who are perceived to be somehow draining the public resources in the United States. We saw so many images where every time you turned around and turned the TV on, you could see a new, what I call the trash news, you know, 48 hours and 60 minutes, where they showed footage of women coming across the border, whether by land, by foot, by river, with hordes of children or hugely pregnant. And then the cameras would switch to a public hospital, a clinic where women were scattered all around with, again, huge with child or with six children around them. The media did a tremendous job of putting out this image that women immigrants were now this great menace who were threatening to drain our public coffers and overwhelm our schools and overwhelm the public hospitals.
Was there a racist undercurrent to this as well?
Definitely. There was a great focus on Latinos in particular. It took a different form when they were talking about Asian immigrants. It was interesting when the focus was on Latina immigrants, it was about all of the official rhetoric. You could see it in the budget reports, some statement about extraordinarily high fertility rates of Latinas. If you look at the studies done by, for example, Wendy Walker at UC Berkeley, it was grossly inflated. And when the focus was on Asian women immigrants, there was this claim that Asian immigrants were bringing in their elderly parents. So it wasn't so much a focus on their fertility, but that, you know, Asian immigrants apparently have these huge families and they bring all of their elderly parents and relatives in to suck up Medicare and Medi-Cal. It was a really interesting new configuration of these racial stereotypes.
We're talking with Dr. Grace Chang, author of the book Disposable Domestics, Immigrant Women Workers in the Global Economy.
Now, a lot of, at least what I know and what I hear of actions, harassment of women seems to be on an individual basis. They get stuck with a bad employer and they get harassed or exploited. In Europe, though, you're starting to see some of these neo-Nazi kinds of movements and anti-immigrant movements that are taking on a bit of a more violent face. Are women facing more persecution because of that?
You know, in this country, I think that there is probably not as much public recognition of how much neo-Nazi activity we have here. There's quite a bit of vigilantism and that type of mass violent movements against immigrants here, much more than is recognized. Earlier this fall, there was a case of two young men from Mexico who were trying to get jobs as day laborers. This was out in Long Island, in New York, and they got lured to a warehouse with the promise that they were going to have day labor contracts, and they were brutally beaten and just really barely escaped being beaten to death by two young white men who felt that they were a threat to their jobs and to the quality of life in the neighborhoods that they lived in. And it's really ironic that these two men were lured to such a brutal beating with the promise of work. I think that that is a really grave irony.
To what extent does the media play a role suggesting that immigrants are somehow a threat to us?
I think that, for example, the kinds of portrayals that are put forth are really irresponsible. They're really deeply racist and misogynist images and lack of coverage of things like, for example, the beating. You know, I think a lot of that vigilante activity goes largely uncovered by mainstream media. I was in a room full of organizers and activists this fall, maybe 2 weeks after that incident had happened. And people that you would expect would be on top of that issue were largely unaware that that had happened because that type of incident is just not covered.
To what extent, perhaps, do the immigrants themselves buy into these images if they're watching American television, let's say?
Oh, I had a really troubling encounter when I was doing some interviews for this book, and I talk about it in the book. I had done a group interview with two women who were domestic workers, and this was in Los Angeles. And they had a lot of their family members present, which is sort of the way that I conducted a good deal of my interviews. And there was a young son and daughter, teenagers, who were helping to do some of the translation. You know, I asked the women what they felt about whether or not immigrants collected welfare often and what their perception was. And one of the young teenage boys interjected, you know, yeah, you know, it's just like this. And he was pointing to this political cartoon that I had in an article that I had brought with me. It was a picture of a woman who was big with child in an inner tube floating down the Rio Grande with a flag, a little U.S. flag that said, you know, U.S. or bust. And he was pointing to it and he said, you know, it's really just like this. You know, I see this all the time. I said, really, where do you see it? And he said, well, I see it on Spanish TV. And I thought to myself, yeah, you and everybody else. I mean, we all saw it. We all saw those images. We were completely bombarded with those images, whether on mainstream TV or Spanish TV. And he was utterly convinced that that was the case, that, you know, there were plenty of Central American and Mexican, and in his mind, it was mainly Mexicans. He believed that that was a Mexican phenomenon.
And what was his ethnic background?
He was Central American. And, you know, I tried to explain that it was exactly a political cartoon. But I don't know that he was convinced. And it's not to say, and I've said this in the book as well, I'm not criticizing him for being ignorant or misinformed as much as I'm saying that that is the power of those images. That's how pervasive those images are, that they get consumed by people that you would hope wouldn't consume those images, would be able to resist those ideas. And that's a very dangerous thing.
To what extent are women organizing to fight for their rights?
You know, there's a lot actually being done, and they're not necessarily your traditional unions, but I encountered quite a few in New York, San Francisco, and L.A. There are definitely groups where women are organizing as domestic workers, as caregivers, and they're having to build their own models. I mean, they are having to figure out how to organize even though they don't have a common workplace. They don't have a common meeting place. They're all sort of isolated within the private households where they work. And they're also having to organize with the understanding that many of them are single mothers or heads of household. They have children of their own, and they're tired, and their children want to see them, and they have to figure out how to, for example, rotate the childcare among themselves so that their kids aren't being left out beyond the workday, but they can still get their organizing work done. And it's very, very encouraging to see how women are building these models of alternative organizing and are very successful in also, for many of them, enlisting their partners, men who initially might have been somewhat reluctant about it, couldn't understand why they needed to do this political work, and in the end came to see the value of it and the importance of it and understood that they needed to support that work as well. So I think that I was very encouraged and very impressed with the level of organizing that is emerging around these issues. Whereas I think that immigrant workers working in private households have a really huge challenge in the fact that they are not in a common workplace. They've really met that challenge to a greater extent than people might recognize.
What did you learn most from these women?
One of the things that surprised me a great deal, because of my preconceptions that many immigrant women would be fearful of talking to me, and some of my initial research made me expect that I would have a lot of trouble getting people who would be willing to talk to me. I found that that was not the case at all, and that there were women who had very much become politicized through this work and not only were willing to talk about it, but saw it as their opportunity to offer some public education around these issues. I think that several of these women really understood the work that they were doing and were able to, with very good humor, say, for example, they would do trainings among the members in their groups, and they would say, if you get confronted with an employer who starts sort of harassing you about, well, do you have a green card? Are you legal? The general sentiment was, just stand up to the employer and say, you know, I'm human. What about you? That was the ethic that I saw coming out of these groups. And I think that's very powerful. I think that that is so far from the conceptions that many people, including myself, had, that people were hiding in the shadows. So I find that to be really encouraging.
So the book is Disposable Domestics, Immigrant Women Workers in the Global Economy. What do you want readers to gain most by reading this book?
One greater understanding I would like to see happen is that immigrants are not the blood-sucking, welfare-cheat breeders that they've been portrayed to be, and that I would like to see a broader understanding of the economic interventions that the U.S. and other first world countries make through things like structural adjustment programs that really essentially force this outflow of women from the third world. I think that that is just not recognized. And I think that people really need to understand the push that is being instigated by first world nations and by, you know, over-debtor nations. And finally, I would like to see a shift from these economic arguments, even though I try to sort of tease them out here and dismantle some of these myths. I would also like to see a fundamental shift to recognizing that women who are providing this type of intimate care for so many members of our society, whether it's the elderly, children, ill people, that they also have fundamental rights to be able to care for themselves and their own families as human beings, beyond the worker rights that they undoubtedly have. People shy away from debating this on those terms.
Dr. Grace Chang, thank you.
Thanks very much.
From the studios of community radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California, USA, I'm Kelia Ramirez.